is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Watching some of these guys who have done it for so long, and the skill set that they have developed as a coach, being at the small college level, it's fascinating because it's a totally different game, especially from a coaching perspective. And, you know, you were talking about Jay Billis, and I think it was Jay that said something along the lines. It's one of my favorite coaching quotes I've ever heard. If you want to coach basketball, you have an opportunity. There's thousands upon thousands of opportunities out there to do it. But there's not so many if what you're doing it for is to become famous.
Coach William Payne is the owner of the College Basketball Process, an all-encompassing platform that helps educate high school basketball players and parents on their college options. William spent 11 years as a college coach. He began his career at a non-accredited school called Music City Christian College, coaching there for 4 years. His last stop in coaching was at the University of Cincinnati Claremont, where he spent 2 seasons. As a player, William played at Free Will Baptist College for 2 years from 1999 to 2000. Coach Payne is passionate about helping players and parents navigate the college basketball process. His Tweets by Coach P Twitter account is a must-follow for high school players and their parents who have aspirations of playing college basketball. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a 5-star rating and review. Believe it or not, those ratings help your friends and colleagues find the show. If you really love what you're hearing, recommend the Hoopheads pod to someone and get them to join you as a part of Hoopheads Nation. Have your pen and paper ready so you can take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach William Payne from the College Basketball Process.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Coach William Payne from the College Basketball Process. William, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
We are very excited to have you on the show. Want to go through and first of all, learn more about you, your background as a player and a coach. And then even more importantly than that, give you a chance to talk about all the great things that you're doing to educate parents and players about what it takes to play college basketball and how the process really works. Because as we all know, there's a lot of misinformation and lack of education when it comes to the knowledge of parents and players. So I think that the service that you're providing is tremendous. So we're going to definitely dive into that as we get more into the interview. I want to start out, though, by talking a little bit about your basketball background and take you back to when you were a kid and what made you fall in love with the game of basketball and how you got into the game when you were a young kid.
Sure. Basketball has been a lifelong love affair for me. There's very few things, if anything, in my life that has been more prominent over the years than the game of basketball. Looking back, the memories stretch back as far as I can remember, being small with a ball in my hand, but having roots, strong family roots in southeastern Kentucky. There is very few things that carry more weight than basketball in southeastern Kentucky. That's just always been something that was extremely prominent growing up and hearing stories of Kentucky basketball and everything that comes along with that, passionate fan base, to say the least. And So I grew up watching guys play on dirt courts that sometimes they were using milk crates for hoops and shooting from 40 feet out like it's nothing. And I remember watching that and just being so in love with it. And it was just something that consumed me from a very early age.
Who was your player that you looked up to when you were a kid? Who was the player you watched on TV who was your guy?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, that's kind of a difficult question to answer. But growing up, my favorite player was Bernard King at Tennessee.
Nice.
Not even close. I feel like he's probably one of the most underrated players in the history of college basketball, NBA as well. And growing up as Bernard King wasn't even close. Most people think that the influence that Southeastern Kentucky had on me with my family means that I was a Kentucky fan, and that's actually not the case. It went the opposite way. And so while it cultivated my passion for basketball, I actually was not a Kentucky fan growing up.
That's interesting.
We were so close to the Tennessee border that I kind of fell in love with the team across the state line.
I love Bernard. And when he had that playoff series where he scored 50 in just about every game and scored every which way that was imaginable. And he's one of those guys that I had an opportunity to talk to Pat Williams from the Orlando Magic, who was the GM of the Sixers back with the Doc Moses, Andrew Toney, Mo Cheeks team. And I talked to him about, you know, he was also the GM of the Magic when they drafted Penny. And I think Penny is one of those guys that, you know, has kind of a lost career that when you look back on, you know, his first couple seasons in the league and how athletic he was and how easily he scored and what a great passer he was. And he was just a phenomenal guy. And then obviously the knee injuries robbed him of that explosiveness. And he ended up playing for a long time still, but, you know, didn't have the career that he probably could have. And I think Bernard, you think back to the time when he was playing and just the technology of, you know, fixing his torn ACL and the fact that he was able to come back and have as good of a career as he did is kind of amazing. He's a guy, again, that I think if he hadn't gotten hurt, I mean, he had a fantastic career as it was, but what he would have been able to do had he not been robbed of his athleticism with the knee injuries, I think would be, he would have been incredible. I mean, he was incredible anyway, but
a top 10 all-time player had he not experienced that. So, and it's funny you mentioned that because if I had to go to, and I hate kind of ranking things, but if I had to go to a second favorite player ever, it would absolutely would be Penny Hardaway. So it's interesting that you said that. While my roots are in Southeastern Kentucky, I'm a Tennessee boy. And so anything Tennessee related with basketball across the state is where, you know, where my bread is really buttered. And so I'm a huge Penny Hardaway guy.
Yeah, Penny was he was phenomenal.
He made great commercials, man.
He did make great little Penny was great commercials.
Listen, I'm young enough that I remember the commercials. I don't really remember seeing him play very much, sadly.
Unbelievable.
I remember, I know he was
great.
But I just remember the little Penny commercials and seeing them, and they would make me laugh.
I'll share my little Penny story. Jason will appreciate this, and you'll probably appreciate it too, William. So I had one of my wife's good friends. We went and visited them one time, and they were living in Michigan at the time, and they had their kids were young, and I didn't have kids at the time, and went there, and they had a little Penny doll, and I just remember you'd press the button and it would have all the sayings from the commercial. And my favorite one was little Penny would say in that, you know, whatever the funny voice, I'm not going to do it very well, but he would say, "The Secret Service couldn't guard me." And I still hear that. I mean, I can conjure that up when somebody says Penny Hardaway. I mean, obviously I think of him as the player, but one of the first things I think about is that little doll and that him saying, you know, the Secret Service couldn't guard me. So that's funny.
It's something, you know, obviously he's in the limelight now because of what he's doing down at Memphis and the recruiting together and this couple state championships that he reined in down at down in Memphis when he was coaching high school a couple years back. But something that a lot of people don't realize about him and being a Tennessee guy, I can kind of relate to and speak to is I would argue that. And obviously there's a ton of players like this throughout the country where they're from. But I don't make this statement lightly. I would argue that Penny Hardaway means more to the city he's from than any other player that I know of. He is such an interwoven part of the fabric of the city of Memphis. The stuff that he's done to give back, the EYBL teams he's had, the high school coaching, the donations and just the things that he's done to that city. It's for the true people from the state of Tennessee and Memphis. I mean, he's it. I mean, he's everything to that city. And I think that oftentimes gets overlooked because of his name and whatnot. But the amount that he's given back and what he's done for that city is amazing.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget. We see professional athletes and we see the things that they do and the money that they make and the fame that they have. And a lot of times guys are doing things for their hometowns and they're doing it quietly. And sometimes it gets reported, sometimes it doesn't. But I think ultimately when guys have that connection to their home city or their home state, and people don't forget that stuff because athletics has such an outsized impact on people's psyche and people feel such a connection that even though they may have never met Penny Hardaway, they've watched him on TV. They've seen his commercials. They've played with his doll, sure. You know, and so they feel that they feel that personal connection. And then when the player returns that feeling by obviously coming back to the city like Penny did and investing and doing those kinds of things, it's just, I mean, it's a credit to what he's been able to do. And obviously there are other guys that do that same thing in their hometowns. But I think you're right in the sense that, you know, there's not many guys who have had the tremendous amount of success that he's had and then come back and coach in high school in the city. And now obviously it seems like he's well on his way to having tremendous success, at the University of Memphis. I don't think there's any doubt that based on what he's been able to do with this recruiting class, that it's only going to be a matter of time before they're right at the top of the rankings year in and year out with him at the helm. So it'll be interesting to watch and see how he develops as a coach and how he develops that program and, you know, where they end up, what heights they're able to reach in, in the world of college basketball for sure.
Definitely agree.
All right. So let's jump back to you.
Sure
and go and talk a little bit about your experiences. Obviously you talked about the beginning part and how you noticed the people in your neighborhood and how they were playing. So talk about as you get towards high school, kind of what your experience was like, summer basketball into your high school experience, then when it started to look like you might have an opportunity maybe to even play beyond high school.
Yeah, so interesting for me, I did not go to a traditional school for middle school and high school. I actually went to a boarding school, very similar to what is thought of today as a prep school, but this is not necessarily a prep as much as it is just a boarding school. So I was there both seventh and eighth grade, starting into my high school days, and it was a really unique environment. Really rural Christian boarding school, very near the Kentucky-Tennessee border. And it provided me an insight into a lot of different things, the diversity and a lot of the players. And I just became fascinated with things that I was learning on the court and different aspects of the game throughout, because the school was represented by every state in the country and several different countries throughout the world, and just seeing different aspects and different different ways of playing the game. And it really lit a fire under me, and went out for the varsity team as a freshman and made it. Was always limited as a player. I was, but if you put me in the corner and get me open, I was going to put it down at the high clip. I can tell you that.
That's it. That's it. You got to have one elite skill, right? One elite skill gets you a lot of places.
Yeah, it did give me a lot of places. So I played varsity basketball throughout my high school days. And just because I maintained good enough grades and whatnot, things started kind of opening up and presenting themselves. I definitely was a better guy on the field for football than I was basketball, but basketball is always where the passion was. Basketball is always where the love was. And because of this, a couple of things kind of opened up. Could have done a lot more on the football field in terms of scholarships and whatnot, but I ended up after my high school days, 4-year starter, ended up deciding to go a small Christian school route at Free Will Baptist. Was there for 2 years. And never really translated very well, but I did pretty well. I was a 2-year starter, but it wasn't quite the success that I'd hoped for. But what that did do was directly open my eyes to what my true passion was going to be, and that was going to be working the sidelines. It was early on that I knew then that I was going to want to go into coaching. That's when that opened the door for me truly.
So what was it about that experience that made you decide, hey, I want to be a coach? Because it sounds like maybe prior to that in high school, that hadn't really crossed your mind. So what was it about your college experience that made you start to think, hey, maybe I want to coach? Was it that you started to see maybe that your playing career was going to eventually come to an end? Or was it passionate about? What was it?
It was what I started finding enjoyment in. While playing was always fun, it was always great. The organized aspect of playing was still absolutely a passion, but I found myself becoming occupied with thoughts of ways to improve others. I found myself being occupied with ideas of drawing up possible plays to run by the coach or different things like that. And so I found myself stepping back and looking at the whole picture more from an outside looking in perspective versus on the court looking out. And that's when I really started thinking, hey, maybe that's what this was all about all along.
So when you start getting that thought in your head, do you start to prep yourself for looking for coaching opportunities when you're finished? Do you start looking for coaching opportunities immediately, like looking to coach a summer team? How do you go about starting to scratch that coaching itch at that point? Or is it something that's still just kind of percolating in your mind with the idea that eventually I'm going to get there? Or do you jump right on it right away when that thought starts coming to you?
Well, so everybody's circumstances and situations extremely different. And I had a very unique set of circumstances. And I became a father at a very early age. And, because of that, I was unable to immediately start following those passions that I had. While I wanted to immediately start looking for those coaching jobs, that did not become a reality simply because I had to do other things in the moment, to provide as a father. And so with that, I had to put that on the back burner and I did not go directly to coaching. That's where the passion and the fire was lit for it, but it would be much later in life that I actually got into coaching.
All right. So in between time, as you're working a job and you're starting to put together and raise your family, talk about what you were thinking about in terms of coaching. Were you formulating a plan of, hey, eventually this is going to happen for me, or did it kind of fade away and you thought, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get this done because of my circumstance? How did that play out as you pushed through that from the future there?
Sure. It was always in the back of my mind that that's what I wanted to do. It was always there that, hey, one day I want to try to make this a reality. The path was not always clear. I didn't always have a vision for that. And there were times that I felt like it wasn't going to happen. I would be lying if I didn't say that there were times that I said I'd given up on it. But there always seemed to be something that pulled me back in, a connection or a former teammate or something that allowed me the opportunity to be pulled back into the game in some facet. And so I had just kind of set my sights on one day making it happen. And while I did not necessarily sit down and formulate that plan, I never lost sight of that ultimate goal of saying there, you know, the opportunity will come along for me to do this one day. I just have to be ready to seize that moment. And so I spent a lot of time truly educating myself from a coaching perspective, just being a student of the game, watching it from a different perspective. Because if you talk to anyone, a fan watching a basketball game is starkly different than a coach watching a game. And learning to watch it from a different perspective, learning how to pick plays apart, just truly watching it from that perspective, going to high school games, talking to high school coaches, and really developing the skill set to be in place if an opportunity ever presented itself.
So that was something that you were doing on a formal basis. I mean, formal meaning that you were consciously and actively
100%.
Saying, I'm going to go and watch this game. Yes. And I'm going to look at it from a coach's perspective. That's 100%. Very cool.
100%. And I would even seek, and that's one of the reasons why I'm such a huge high school guy. Because I think some of the greatest X's and O's coaches in the country are at the high school level. I would seek a lot of high school coaches out and just kind of explain my position and my background and just ask if I could even sit in on practices or just various things like that, if I could help. And that's kind of where the connection started being made. And I just never gave up on it. I even started keeping a notebook of plays that I had drawn up and stuff that I'd learned. And that one notebook quickly turned into 20, and it quickly turned into 50. And so it was just one of those things. I said that I was going to be both mentally and skillfully prepared for when the opportunity presented itself, if an opportunity presented itself. And then I kind of resign myself to the fact that, hey, I don't know if this is going to present itself, so I'm going to have to go out and look for it.
All right. So during that time, while you're going out and you're going to high school practices and you're talking to coaches, Do you remember anything that stood out for you at that time, like a practice you went to and a coach was doing something unique, and not necessarily unique from maybe an X's and O's standpoint, but more from just a team building, or maybe a conversation that you had with a coach said, hey, did you ever think about this? Or they shared something that was maybe different from what your experience was as a player. Cause I know one of the things that I always look at is you go through life with basketball as a player. And when you're a player, you really only can see the team that you're on, the coach that you're playing for. And so when I'm playing in high school, my only perspective of what a high school coach does or is my high school coach. Unless I'm going out as a player, which most players aren't, and I certainly wasn't at the time, I'm not going out and watching other teams practice. I'm having very few conversations with players from other teams at that time. Hey, what's your coach like? I only know my own situation. So do you remember anything from that time that maybe was different from your experience of what a coach was from the player perspective that opened your eyes to something that maybe you hadn't thought about coaching from the perspective of when you were a player? Is that question, if that question makes any sense to you?
No, it does make sense. And I can actually pinpoint an exact coach. His name was Coach Hawkins. I'd actually went back. He's high school coach at a small school called Oneida Baptist Institute. And I had I went to a practice, and growing up, I'd always played for just extremely hard-nosed, my way or the highway kind of coaches. And something presented itself in one of his practices I sat in on that was extremely unique to me. It was the first time I'd ever experienced a player's coach before. And someone who I very much patterned much of my coaching philosophies off him. He kept it. So a lot of times I've been exposed to coaches that had very intricate playbooks, extremely detailed coaching philosophies and schemes. And he ran it very simple. And he had the philosophy of, we may not do a lot of things, but the things that we do, we're going to do extremely well. And that I've kind of patterned my coaching philosophy after for a number of years. It was the first time I was ever exposed to that, all the way back to middle school coaching and high school coaching and everything in between had always been extremely hard-nosed. Just guys that, hey, it's this way or that way. And to be exposed to a different aspect of coaching, especially that input from players, is the first time I'd ever seen a coach actually bringing a player up and saying, hey, what are you seeing here? What do you think we could do to improve that? And it was just a fascinating approach to me. And I've kind of patterned myself after that all these years.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing? I think that's something that it's much more prevalent, obviously, now than it was back in the time I graduated from college in 1992. So the time when I was playing, there was far more of the Bobby Knight model of coaching, as opposed to the relationship type of coaching that we see being utilized by most coaches today. It's a totally different world. And I think, to your point, the first time that you see that different model, it's a little bit difficult for somebody who's been in those other situations to kind of wrap your mind around the way that it's going. I know that, you know, my coach that I played for in college was not a Bobby Knight type coach from a standpoint of the yelling and the, you know, the language and that kind of thing. It was more of a psychological way of getting under your skin to try to motivate you. But there certainly wasn't the relationship type of building like what you're describing there. And I often wonder, and again, I have no complaints about what I was able to do in college and the experience that I had, but you oftentimes wonder, just to go back to what I said before, where the only experience that you know is the one that is in front of you. And I often thought, even while I was playing, man, it would be really cool to go and watch Ohio University practice and see how their practices are different from ours. Or it would be very cool to go and be involved in a North Carolina practice with Dean Smith to see what that looks like. And I think that when you do get an opportunity as a coach, it's one of the most interesting things that I've found as a coach, is to be able to go and talk to other coaches and just see how many different ways there are to, ultimately, all of us as coaches, we're all trying to accomplish the same thing, which is to win games and hopefully to have a positive impact on our players. Absolutely. And there's so many different ways to do that. And I think that's what's fascinating about coaching.
Yeah, there's definitely not a one-size-fits-all model. And I think what really stood out for me about what Coach Hawkins was doing was being a guy that, you know, a Tennessee guy. I don't know how familiar you guys are with this name, but if you don't know, you need to take the time to research it, because he's widely considered one of the greatest college basketball coaches in the country at any level. But having attended some of the old legendary Don Meyer camps at Lipscomb.
For sure. We just talked to I was down at the Jay Billis Skills Camp, and Lenny Acuff, who just took over at Lipscomb, was there speaking. So we're hoping we're going to grab him in the next couple of weeks and have him on. But yeah, Meyer, obviously, legend.
He's the, you know, I've heard this said about him before. He's the greatest coach that most have never heard of. And I would argue that he's the greatest coach that anyone has either heard of or not heard of. It doesn't matter. I mean, he's that good. And but he was also probably the most intense man that I ever met. And because of that, that's kind of, like I said, growing up in the mold and the models that I had seen, it was just so fascinating to see this other perspective from Coach Hawkins. And what was really interesting is I initially thought that, oh, he's going to struggle demanding respect from these players. And he didn't. I was floored. I thought that they were going to walk all over him and not listen, but it was just the opposite. And I think you have to tailor things to fit the players and vice versa. But it just stuck with me so strongly that I really did pattern my coaching philosophy after him. So you're right. Everybody has a different way of doing it, but the goals are the same.
All right. So you go through that whole prep process of getting yourself ready, thinking in the back of your mind that at some point you're going to get an opportunity to coach. You study some of the best coaches that are out there. You go and you talk to high school coaches, you attend practices. At what point then does the opportunity to start to realize your coaching dream? Describe how that process came to be and how you got your first opportunity in the game to be a coach.
As any type of actual official coach, the opportunity presented itself, as it does to many people, in the summer game at the AAU level. And I'd had a real strong tie to the AAU level because the boarding school that I attended, it was back in the old days where your AAU team was your high school team. And that's was always kind of a strong memory for me because of the bonding and everything that came with that. But I had an opportunity to go into coaching with a what I would consider a fairly high level AAU program in Tennessee. And the coach approached me, and it was simply nothing more than asking me to fill in for a weekend because there was a family emergency and he couldn't make it. And that's literally how I got my first coaching job. I stepped up, filled in, to the wild success of an 0-3 weekend.
And, you get offers from all over the place, right?
Yeah, I started to get it. I mean, I don't even know how I managed to fill all the calls that came in from that. Not only was it a wildly successful 0-3 weekend, but I'm embarrassed to admit that I was actually ejected from one of the games. So it was not a good start. And I went home and thought that, hey, this might not be for me the way I think. That's how I started. And I started hanging around the practices. He asked me to come back. And luckily, we had not a lot of programs did, but we had a person that did our filming, and he sat down and he watched the games. And he broke down some stuff that I was doing, and he didn't say anything negative aside from me getting ejected. And he broke down some of the strong points and things that he wanted to build on. And he said, so here's your opportunity. And this, like I said, it was a fairly high level AAU program. It was funded. And he said, I want to bring you on as an assistant. And a lot of, you know, because it was patterned after what it's like to play for a college program. And he said, I want to bring you on. It won't be a paid position, but this is what we'll be doing. You won't have to pay for anything out of your pocket. I just won't be able to pay you anything. And that's where I got my start. And I did that for 3 seasons. And through that, as tends to happen with a lot of things, I made a lot of college connections because the players that are on the court did that for me. And I think that's oftentimes overlooked. It's great to be a wonderful coach. It's great to have the best schemes and the best game plans and all that in place. But at the end of the day, it makes our job a whole lot easier when we have really good players out on the court. And those players are what really opened the door for me to have the opportunities to meet some of these college coaches and help get my name out there and really just do the legwork to help them along the process. And to be able to know these people and reach out to them. And so that's how I got contacted for my first college job.
All right, two things from that. One, I love your point about the fact that ultimately, as coaches, we can be the best coaches out there in the world with our X's and O's and our relationship building and everything else that goes into being a good coach. But ultimately, the players help to drive our success. So no matter what level of basketball I'm at, if I don't have players, I can be a good coach, I can be a bad coach, whatever. I'm not going to have the success that I'm going to have without players. And so I think players deserve to have sometimes get more credit for the success that coaches have than sometimes coaches want to give them credit for. So I think that's a great point. And then the second thing that I wanted to ask you about that is, during those 3 years that you spent there, what was one or two things that you learned that eventually helped you throughout your entire coaching career? What are one or two things that you learned during that 3 years as working with the AAU program that helped you to be a better coach for the rest of your career?
Well, first and foremost, what I just said that we just touched on is that if you have good players, you have a good team.
Absolutely.
And honestly, I can't say that enough. I mean, kind of speaking back to the coaching philosophy of being a player's coach, I learned that if you prepare, you put the work in with good players, you do the work to get them on the court, that a lot of times your best chance of success is to step back and let them play. And that philosophy has never left me. And that, above anything else, is the primary thing I took. There's obviously many aspects of basketball that you are not exposed to unless you're in the AAU game. And so some of the other things that I learned that I'll never let go of is bonding. I think that's an overlooked aspect of the AAU game today. AAU basketball gets a lot of a bad rap, bad publication, and some of it is deserved. But a lot of things that are overlooked are the morning continental breakfast, the bus rides, you know, or the car rides, and playing four games in a day, and just being dead dog tired when you get back to the hotel room with each other, and everything that kind of comes along with that. It's unique to AAU specifically. And it also kind of touches on my one of my core foundation beliefs of just that absolute bonding. And so I took that because it's kind of a somber note. It also allowed me to see how many kids were never going to realize their dream. Everybody goes into AAU basketball season thinking that they're going to be discovered, or a coach is going to see them and offer them a scholarship or give them a chance to play at the next level. And the reality is that that's going to happen at a far fewer percentage opportunity than people realize. So seeing people have to struggle out on the court and come off and not have their dreams realized of a scholarship, and the bonding that kind of comes along with that is just, it's very unique and something I'm thankful that I got to experience.
Head Start Basketball is proud to announce that we will be hosting the very first Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Camp that is held annually in Charlotte, North Carolina. The first Prime Skills Camp will take place on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, in partnership with the Jay Billis Skills Camp. The camp will be designed for boys rising to grades 7 through 9 and will take place August 2nd through the 4th. Prime Skills Camps will mirror the Jay Billis Skills Camp in daily programming, teaching, coach-to-camper ratio, and quality of instruction. Pace and physicality of drills and other programming will be adapted to suit a younger player, but an emphasis on improving your individual skills in the context of a team environment will continue to be the hallmark of Prime Skills Camps. Please visit headstartbasketball.com or jbilliscamp.com for more information or to get registered.
I think there's a lot of misinformation that goes to what you're doing now, which we'll get to, and that is just a lack of education, knowledge, however you want to put it, in terms of what parents and players know about the college basketball recruiting process and the opportunities that are out there. There's a lack of education. I think there's a lack of education to take it even a step lower on the, you know, on the level is there's a lack of education in terms of how do I select the right AAU program? How do I go about understanding what it is that my kid should be doing, needs to be doing, wants to be doing when it comes to players who are youth players? And I think a lot of times parents, especially ones that are going through the system for the very first time, they don't know what they don't know. And a lot of times it leads to them, unfortunately, making poor decisions that don't allow them to maximize the experience for their kid, which for some kids, they want the experience of playing at a high level and getting exposure and trying to get a college scholarship. But there's a large percentage of kids that get kind of thrown into the same system that probably would be just as happy practicing once a week and playing at a more recreational level. They'd probably have more fun doing 100%. That. And yet parents kind of are forced into one system oftentimes because they just don't know what they're supposed to be doing with their kids. So we'll jump into that in a minute. Sure. Let's go back to you getting your first opportunity to coach at a school and what that looked like and how that opportunity came about.
So yeah, that it's an interesting setup. The first opportunity came at a very interesting institution that I guarantee you 98% of the people in the area have never even heard of. It was at a very small, later to be determined, non-accredited university called Music City Christian College. And they kind of used that name more so for recognition because it wasn't even actually in Nashville. It was further closer to Kentucky. It was very interesting school. And it was centered around every degree that they offered. As I mentioned, it was later determined that it was non-accredited, but every degree path that they offered was based in biblical studies. And a lot of kids went through there. It wasn't a great situation for them academically, but you mentioned people making uninformed decisions. While it ended up working out well for me, I made a very uninformed decision to jump in there because I didn't know some of the things that came with it in terms of being non-accredited and whatnot. But I jumped on as a volunteer coach, no money. But I saw the college label on the name and thought, hey, here's my big break. And to some extent, it absolutely was. And so I come in and we don't have a gym. We're literally having to make phone calls every day asking high schools, middle schools, elementary schools to use their gym, not only for practices, but for games. In the years that I was there, we played games in a YMCA elementary school. And we even, this is a true story, we even considered figuring out a way to play a game outside.
Not on the aircraft carrier in San Diego.
No. I'm talking about at a city park in White gotcha. House.
They still play basketball outside down there.
Yeah. outdoor basketball is dying faster than just about anything in the country, unfortunately.
And what's crazy about that is it's, in my opinion, still the number one skill developer of anything you can do.
I'm with you 100%, William. I couldn't agree more. It's one of the things that I despise about the current system is the fact that it takes kids off of the playground where they play without an official, without you know, with people of different ages when you're 14 and you're playing.
Many good skills to learn on the blacktop. In fact, you know, we'll talk about this later, but one of the platforms I have now with social media is I oftentimes just put out these little coaching tidbits of wisdom. And recently I made a post pretty blatantly saying, hey, you know, forget the trainers, forget the Vertimax, grab a basketball, find a blacktop court with guys about 10 years older than you and spend the whole summer playing.
Exactly. I couldn't agree more.
And it's literally, I mean, you learn so much. One of the things that I find with today's game is so many kids are obsessed with it not being fair. A call didn't go this way, or a call didn't go that way, or playing time or whatnot. And you learn really quickly when you play on those blacktop streets and in the courts that it's not going to be fair. And you got to learn how to play through contact. You either win or you sit down. You're not getting foul calls. I mean, there's so many valuable just on ball defense when the game becomes kind of one-on-one. There's just so many things that that can come from that. And I think it is absolutely a dying lost art.
I could not agree more. I've stumped for that on numerous episodes, and it's one of the things that I just know how great that was for me, not just from a basketball perspective, but just from a life perspective. To be exposed to the different types of people, the different ages of people. And, you know, I have guys that I played with at that time that, you know, were all different ages, all different types of backgrounds that I still talk to, that I'm still friends with today. And I think kids, we miss out on that. And there's a lot of positive to the system today without question, but the fact that the demise of playground basketball to me is a tragedy, because I know how important and influential that was in my life. And I oftentimes see kids today, and I think of even my own kids, and I'm sad that they didn't get to experience that same thing that I was able to experience. And part of it is we parent differently in today's society. And we don't just let our kids out the door the way that I was let out the door to go and play wherever we wanted to play. And I think that definitely has had an impact, but it's something that I'm sad about it every time I think about it, because I know how great that was for me as a kid. And like I said, not just from a basketball perspective, but just from a life skills and just being able to get along with people and stand up for yourself and, you know, pick your teams and
100%.
Get this guy and all that stuff. There's so much that can be learned from it from a non-basketball point of view. That's applicable to basketball, obviously, but also is applicable to life. And I'm
absolutely
I'm sad about it every single day.
Well, and if you're not using basketball as a game to correlate with life lessons, then I think you're missing the boat to begin with.
No question.
And so it's absolutely a lost art and things. And I think it shows, and not only on the court, but I think it shows with some of the decisions that are made and just the way that some of the paths are taken with the young people today. And I think I absolutely believe there's a correlation there. So, but yeah, we, you know, kind of back on that topic, we literally tried to schedule a game on blacktop, and was there for you know, a number of years, and it really opened my eyes to another world. Having been at Free Will Baptist, I thought that was, as to be honest, I thought that was as low as it got, and I quickly learned that we were in luxury, and was there until the door shuttered. When it closed, there were only 52 students. And every one of those students later found out that nothing that they had done their entire time there counted for anything. And if you talk about a strong life lesson, that was one. I felt really guilty after that. I even questioned sticking around coaching, because I had a part in a lot of those kids coming to school. And that was tough for me. But I had to take a step back and really, you know, determine what my goals were, what my passions were. And I did everything I could in my power to assist those young men in finding new places to attend college. And I'm happy to say many of them did. But what it did do, more than anything, that really, truly solidified my love for the small college game. People sometimes confuse my message to mean that I don't enjoy D1 basketball. I love D1 basketball. I mean, I absolutely love it. But from a professional standpoint and a true passion standpoint, I'm just in love with the small college basketball game. I think so many aspects of it are the epitome of amateurism, and that's why I love it. So, and that's what that did for me. And once I left there, I kind of bounced around, JUCO out in West Tennessee. I was there for a year, bounced around as a volunteer at another school that closed down in Jackson, Tennessee, Lambeth. Kind of bounced around and ended up after a couple of years, ended up and being offered a job up in Cincinnati, just outside of Cincinnati, at University of Cincinnati Claremont. And that's what I moved up to the Ohio area for. So came up here about 3 years ago, was part of that program for 2 years. There were funding issues that came involved, and I had to make a very tough, difficult decision to walk away from coaching after I, you know, moved the family up. And it's part of the game that many people tend to overlook. You know, coaches, especially at the small college level, there's not a lot of money involved. You move your families and uproot your life. And, you know, there are consequences when that happens. And so had two really solid years there. Things went really well, actually. But it was just a funding issue with the school and money that they pay coaches. There was a couple changes. I actually stepped away, and I think this speaks volumes about how some people look at me in the game. There was a new coach that was brought in that signed up. He was okay with the funding and came on board. And I was actually asked to stick around on his staff. And that's rare that happens. And I think in all of my coaching days, that's probably the thing I'm the most proud of, is the fact that an entire new staff came in and that guy said, "Hey, I want you to stick around. I know you can help me. I have a staff coming in, but I need you." And I'm very thankful for that. And it's absolutely one of the things I'm most proud of in all of my coaching.
I think that when you get a reputation as somebody who does a good job, and we all know that coaches talk and the fraternity is very, very small, and you're one or two people away from being connected to just about anybody you'd want to be connected to when it comes to coaching. And I think that it is a credit to you, because oftentimes when coaches come in and we get a new staff, that new head coach that comes in, they want, quote, their guys. And if you're not one of their guys, it sometimes becomes difficult to stick around in your job. So the fact that you were able to do that, I think, speaks volumes about the type of coach and the type of person that you are and that you were at that time. And I'll take one step further. One of the things that you said that I think is important to mention, actually, there's probably two things. One that you said was the fact that people don't often realize the hardships that it takes to be a college coach. And, you know, people see the glamorous Division I jobs, and they see the John Calipari's, they see the Tony Bennett's, they see the Roy Williams, they see those guys on TV, and they think that that's what college basketball coaching is all about. And obviously there are some glamour jobs like that.
Sure.
But there's a lot less than there are of the guys who are, you know, director of basketball operations, or the third assistant, or the GA, or the volunteer guy that's doing the film, and or you're the second assistant at a Division III program, or you're the lone assistant in an NAIA program, or you're a volunteer assistant at one of these levels. And those guys are grinding away and doing the same work, and oftentimes being paid very little or sometimes nothing to do something that they're very, very passionate about. And I think people sometimes forget that. And then to piggyback off that thought, the other thing that I think you mentioned that is really important, and it's one of the things that came across this weekend when I was down in Charlotte with the Billis Skills Camp, was that the number of coaches who shared stories about being either with somebody who was a coach, somebody that they knew that coached at a lower, less glamorous level than the Division I level, and saying that this guy is the best coach that I know, and he's the coach of a Division III school, or he's a coach of an NAIA school. And it's not necessarily for those guys, it's not necessarily about climbing the coaching ladder. It's about being in a place that they feel comfortable, that they can do their coaching. And I think that's something that there's a public misperception, and there's apparent misconception that the best coaches are these guys who are at glamour programs in Division I. And obviously there are some tremendous coaches at that level, but I think people discount the fact that there are tremendous coaches at every single level of college basketball.
Yeah, I wish people knew that and truly understand that idea, because you know, it's difficult for me to just pick one person. You know, a lot of times I'm asked, you know, right now, who you feel the best coach is, or, you know, tell me some names that are great. And I'll cheat a little bit here, and I won't pick someone who's technically a current coach because he officially retired a few weeks back. But to kind of fit that mold that you're talking about, and I can't express this enough. This time last year, I would have called him a top 10 coach in the country, and his name is Bob Williams. He coached at West Virginia University Tech Institute, the Tech campus of West Virginia University, NAIA school in the River States Conference. He's a legend. He coaches circles around pretty much anybody who steps on the court with him. And just watching some of these guys who have done it for so long, and the skill set that they have developed as a coach, being at the small college level, it's fascinating because it's a totally different game, especially from a coaching perspective. And, you know, you were talking about Jay Billis, and I think it was Jay that said something along the lines. It's one of my favorite coaching quotes I've ever heard. If you want to coach basketball, you have an opportunity. There's thousands upon thousands of opportunities out there to do it, but there's not so many if what you're doing it for is to become famous. Yep. And I think that kind of fits the bill of what we're talking about here. There's a lot of opportunity to go out there and coach. There's a lot of great coaches out there that do it. To become famous, there's very few. But there's just so many great coaches. Kelly Wells down at the University of Pikeville is one of the greatest coaches I've ever met. Bob Williams was one of them. A coach that just retired that coached my son for a couple of years. Unbelievable NAIA coach. Paul Peck was at Lindsey Wilson. He's one of the greatest coaches I've ever encountered. Just an insanely gifted basketball mind. Some of these, they're just all across the board. They're all over the place. Coach down, Chris at Georgetown College in Kentucky. He's an amazing young coach. Coach RJ Barsh down at Southeastern. I mean, I could go on and on and on. There's so many great coaches that people just have no idea about because you don't see them on TV every day, but that doesn't mean that they're any less gifted.
There are still three more sessions of Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. July 8th through the 12th, we'll be in Strongsville and Avon Lake, and then we'll wrap up our summer of 2019 at the Brunswick Recreation Center from July 29th through August 2nd. Don't forget about the Prime Skills Camp, an affiliate of the Jay Billis Skills Camp that we'll be hosting on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, from August 2nd to the 4th. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, for more information and get registered today.
All right, let's use that as a springboard to jump into how you got started with what you're doing now and why you're so passionate about it and why there's such a need for it. Just kind of go into the thought process of how you started thinking about educating parents, educating players about the fact that there's more than one way, more than one destination that you can get to if you want to keep the ball bouncing after high school. So talk a little bit about how that process got started, and then we'll dive into what you're hoping to accomplish with what you're doing.
Yeah. So when the coaching ended at University of Cincinnati Claremont, I really had made a decision to walk away from the sideline for good. Small college game can really take a grind on you. We were talking about that earlier, just wearing multiple hats, being the van driver, the person who does the laundry. I mean, just so many aspects of it. I had decided that it was probably best for me to at least take a lengthy break. I went back and finished my degree, and decided I was just going to go back into, you know, private employment. And I am a licensed therapist. And so I did that for a little while. And I just really started getting that itch again. Right. I mean, everybody does after a little while. And did not really know what I was going to do to scratch that itch. My oldest son was heading off to college to play. I had never really gotten to enjoy that aspect the way I wanted to. Had another son who's getting ready to, you know, move into high school, and really good player. And I didn't really know what I was going to do. I was kind of at a crossroads. Was happy in my job and my career, but was really missing basketball. But it made promises that I wasn't going to coach because I was going to be there for them. And so a few different people played a role in the birth of this. I was actually hired by what I now know was a recruiting service, which I'm not a big fan of. At the time, I thought that's not really what they were. I was hired as on as a recruiting service to be kind of wear multiple hats, be a scout, and kind of take the company, help take the company in a different direction with new ideas and a few things like that. But I quickly realized that that wasn't for me. It was more of a salesman job, and that's not what I wanted to do. And so I backed out of that. But what that taught me was that there was such a need, and being in small college basketball basically my whole life, I already knew that there was a need, but I think that really showed me the need for some type of platform on the small college game in general, and not just a small college game, but the process surrounding everything with college basketball. Have a friend that's an ESPN broadcaster. He stepped in and kind of mentioned some things to me that he thought I was good at. Some coaching friends spoke with me about using my voice. I've always done fairly well about gaining a following and people kind of listening to my message. And so all that kind of came together. But something I didn't even share with you when we were talking is the real reason behind the college basketball process is my son. I had a son who I still have a son, but coming out of high school, he was extremely highly recruited. He scored almost 1,000 points his senior year alone. 6'5", two guard, prototypical, you know, big time college basketball player. He won the Tennessee High School All-Star Slam Dunk Championship, played at a really good high school, just played a really high level AAU program. Just a typical, you know, first team All-State kid. He was a final ballot Mr. Basketball candidate, everything you want in a big time, you know, high school and college basketball player. And I kind of use him sometimes when I'm doing speaking engagements and telling people how difficult it is to actually get a scholarship. You know, if I blindly used his resume and just broke everything down, you'd say he's absolutely a D1 player. Well, he's not. And it kind of dawned on me watching him all through his high school years and everybody telling him he was going to X, Y, and Z school, and that he was a clear cut ACC player, or that he was going to go to this school or that school. And it, you know, everything was just kind of a perfect storm. And I realized that there's so much information out there looking back on, and again, this is coming from a coach's son, and watching this process as both dad and a coach, it was kind of, it was fascinating. And I quickly realized just how much information exists that is inaccurate. And it continues to present itself almost daily. So I decided to start the college basketball process. Didn't even know what it was going to be called. And just decided to use Twitter as a means, because I've had success on Twitter before. And I was like, you know, I'm going to go into this hopefully with the idea of helping two or three kids get an opportunity to go to college. And if I gain a couple hundred followers in the process, great. We're less than a year old. We're at 20,000 followers. And as of today, I have counted, we've directly assisted almost 260 kids with opportunities to play at the college level. And I never envisioned that taking place. I still get a little mesmerized by it. I can't believe it's even happened. You know, people ask us all the time, and I'm sure you want to ask, so I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I don't even know what we are. people ask daily, you know, what do you do? What are you? What are you here for? And I really don't know, because we are growing at a rate that I never envisioned. We are asked to do new things almost daily. And so we continue to kind of pivot and morph into something new almost daily. And at its core, we do have a foundation of education, information, and resources. and today was the first day someone asked me what we do. And today was the first time I felt comfortable with an answer. Now, I got to be honest, tomorrow that may be different. but I think the college basketball process exists to be a real resource for anyone who needs it within college basketball. And I say that because even though I originally started with the hope and expectation of assisting players and parents, today alone, I found out that I've assisted two young coaches in gaining their first college job interviews. And so this isn't just a parent and player resource. This is for people who need it across the gamut. Both are young men who are trying to get their foot in the door in the coaching industry. And I was able to call on friends, both in really good jobs and kind of vouch for both of them. And now both are being interviewed. And so it's really just kind of whatever you need. At its core, obviously, we try to educate players and parents about the process. I talked to a parent today that was sharing some story about her child, and there's so much misinformation that exists that this is actually something that was said in the conversation. She said, and I know you probably don't know this, but believe it or not, Western Kentucky is a Division I school. And I said, what'd you say? And she said, yeah, I mean, it's just Western Kentucky, but believe it or not, they're a Division I school. And I said, yeah, I'm very aware of that. She said, well, most people don't know that. Most people think that there's some small D3 school or something. I said, oh, okay. I didn't realize most people thought that. So I said, by the way, let me tell you a little fun fact about Western Kentucky. They were the first school in NCAA Division I history to win 30 games in a season. And she said, oh, really? I didn't know that. I said, yeah. So they're not quite as non-Division I as you think. So that's just an example of some of the misinformation that's out there and people just don't understand. They don't know what they don't know. And if it's not on TV, they think it's not relevant. So what I'm trying to do is really build this platform on educating people about options that exist outside of Division I. And sometimes even Division I to a certain extent, because there's a great example of how people just don't even understand. If they don't see it on TV, they don't think it's even a part of Division I. So to some extent, Division I, but we primarily focus on D2, NAIA, Division III, USCAA, the Christian College Associations, which are the NCCAA and the ACCA. We also do a lot with JUCO and the California JUCO Conference. And we just try to teach about the scholarship variances, the different things that exist eligibility-wise across the gamut. One of the things that I do is I put out a lot of tweets that are informational-based and try to provide information that people just aren't aware of. As an example, sometimes I'll put a tweet out or I'll do a Periscope just discussing the variances in scholarship opportunities from Division II to NAIA. Currently, Division II and the NCAA can offer up to 10 scholarships, and this is the last year that the NAIA will be two divisions. Division I can do up to 11. Division II can do 6. Next year, they're merging into one division, and that number is going to be 8 across the board. But the really confusing part is the up to part. Up to that number, people believe that because they can offer 10 that they do. And I can give you examples of Division II schools that are less than 10 miles apart. One school offers full 10 rides and the other school has one scholarship across the entire basketball team. So it's really hard to kind of navigate the landscape and understand what's really out there, much less the scholarship potential, the eligibility requirements, learning that there's so many opportunities for work study, the faith-based schools. There's just so many things out there that people don't know about. And I just want to kind of do my part to bridge that gap.
Do you find that people that you talk to initially who maybe have not accessed your content previously for whatever reason, but then they kind of stumble across what you're doing or somebody points them in your direction. What I tend to think is that most people, as you're describing, see college basketball only through the window of what they see on TV. And so I'm guessing that when somebody initially comes to you who maybe has a child who is good enough to be able to play college basketball, but maybe not Division I college basketball, that I'm guessing that those people oftentimes when they hear, well, your child's good enough to play Division II, or I think they're a Division III player, I think that they could play at the NAI level, I'm guessing there's quite a bit of resistance, at least initially, from a lot of people and parents simply because they just don't understand. I say this all the time, that people have no idea how good you have to be to play college basketball at any level. They have no understanding, and I'm guessing that people kind of blow off, for lack of a better term, anything that's not a Division I.
Yes, 100%. I could be wrong about this, but I can't think of another area or walk of life that being in the top 6% will still get you badmouthed. I mean, let that sink in for a minute. If you're in the top 6% of CEOs in the country, well, you're doing pretty well for yourself. If you're in the top 6%, you know what? And you don't even have to go to that extreme. If you're a top 6% White Castle manager, I guarantee you're hitting a pretty nice bonus. And so the reality is, I can't think of another walk of life that being in the top 6%, people still look at you and say, you're not good enough. And that's a reality in college basketball. Only 6% move on to the next level. There's a lot of misinformation. People say only 3%, but that actually speaks to the false narrative of the NCAA being the only thing that matters. That number is applicable to the NCAA, but across all gamuts, across all levels and associations, a little bit more than 6% make it to play college basketball. And you're spot on. It's very frequent that I will speak to a parent that reaches out and asks for assistance or guidance or to become members. We offer memberships to people on various levels. And when we're having that initial conversation, it's frequent and common for me to hear things like, yeah, but you don't understand our scenario, or but he's getting interest from X, Y, and Z Division I school. And then part of what we do is when we offer an evaluation, when that evaluation comes back, it's oftentimes not popular because they've mistaken generic interest for something that matters. And to be the one to break that news to them after 10 trainers and 5 AAU coaches and a high school coach that's doing it for the first time, and all these people have said, hey, your kid's going to go to Ohio State. And then to be the first person to say, I'm not sure that your kid's going to play college basketball. That's, you know, and in some instances, I can't really blame the family, because if they've been told that for 5-10 years.
Right. From people they perceive to be experts.
Yes. Yes. I mean, who's really at fault here? And I'm not sure that there's any easy way to fix it. There's just so much misinformation that there's really no easy place to start. And that's where I kind of found myself when I was starting this. I was like, well, what am I going to do? What is the foundation? I don't even know where to start. So that's another reason why I don't want to kind of pigeonhole myself into saying we're just one thing. We really want to be an ultimate resource for those in need, those that need help navigating the waters. I mean, I can share stories with you guys that would absolutely floor you. There's a kid in Tennessee I know really well. Kind of fits the bill of what you were just talking about. They thought he was a Division I kid, clearly a college basketball player, but he wasn't a Division I kid. For a year straight, he got hand-signed letters weekly, two of them, from a major ACC school, hand-signed by the head coach. And I'm not joking. It was for a year straight. I can personally attest to this. And after a while, it got to the point where they wanted to know what was going on, why they continued to receive these letters, but no phone calls or whatnot. And I found them very fascinating because some of them were even handwritten. And it was just really bizarre to me that he continued to receive these, because I knew this kid couldn't play at that level. And so I called in some personal favors and got one of the assistants on the phone at this school. And come to find out, there wasn't a single person on the men's basketball staff that had ever even heard of this kid. And I was floored, so I had to do a little more digging and research into what was happening. And I won't put the school's name out there, but basically what occurred is some schools have requirements where they have to bring in so many people from the admissions department. You know, there's numbers that they have to meet through admissions and whatnot. And so this school had obtained a lot of players' names from an AAU tournament and randomly just started sending out stuff. And the head coach would sit down every couple of months and just sign a mass amount of letters, and they would mail them out with the hopes of these players applying to the school and paying the admission fee. So those kind of things exist. So it's not just from the trainers. It's not just from AAU coaches. Those kind of things exist even from the universities. And if I have to be the one to say, hey, those 100 letters don't mean anything, I can completely understand why the parent would think I'm crazy.
For sure.
Right. I mean, how are they supposed to believe me when they have 100 letters in their hand signed by the head coach? And so there's just so much misinformation out there. So much, it's almost like there has been a shift in so it's bizarre because it's almost like people view going to a small college as a step down from high school. And the only thing that's a step up is if you're going D1, and anything else is almost like a step down. And, I don't know how that happened. I don't know where that started taking place, because back in the 70s, there was unbelievable basketball at the NAIA level, and there still is. But I mean, it was at a high level. And, I don't really know where that shift occurred or how it happened. I think it's just kind of morphed over the years with AAU culture, just social media, Twitter, Ball is Life stuff. Just all of that stuff has kind of played a small role in creating this monster that I think is now out of control.
Yeah. I mean, I look back on my playing career, and I know that, you know, I had the dream of being a Division I basketball player. And part of what drove me, I think, is that I would see guys around me that I played against, whether it was during the season or during the summer, and measured myself against those guys and felt that I was as good, if not better than them. And a lot of those guys signed to go play long before I had an opportunity to sign and figure out where I was going to go. And so I think that, unfortunately for me, that comparison game is what drove me. It turned out to be fortunately, because I did end up getting an opportunity and I ended up being in the right place and having a great career. And I'm not sure that that would have happened at every Division I school. I just happened to land in a place that ended up being perfect for me and the type of player that I was. But I can honestly say that as a player at that time, I had a high school coach who had never had anybody that was a player of my ability that was going to be recruited. My parents, and obviously I was the oldest child, so they had never gone through that experience. So we had no idea what the process was like. I just knew that I wanted to play Division I basketball. I'll give you a great story, William. So when I was this was the summer before my senior year, I believe. And at that time, I was talking to a couple of Division I schools, including Kent State, where I eventually ended up. And okay. Kent called me up and they said, we want you to come down and make an official visit. Now, keep in mind, this is the summer before my senior year. So at that point, even back in the 80s when I was being recruited, a lot of the recruiting was, you know, you had a pretty good idea of where you were going to, you should have had a pretty good idea of where you were going to be going to school or what level you were going to be recruited at by that point in your, in your high school career. But I had no idea that that was the case. So when I got this call from Kent that I was, you know, they wanted me to come down and take an official visit, I told them, no, I'm not going to take an official visit. I'll come down and take an unofficial visit, because I still thought at that point that, you know, I got to save my visits for Ohio State and Carolina and Duke, because, you know, why am I wasting my time? Oh, I don't want to waste. Yeah, I'm like, I don't want to waste my official visit to go down to Kent. So I went down with my mom, and I still remember it plain as day. I went into the coach's office and sat down and talked to the head coach, talked to the assistant. And then my mom and I walked over, you know, and had lunch at Wendy's and, you know, paid for the lunch ourselves. And we were probably on campus, you know, for a total of, you know, a couple hours. I may have met a player or two.
Sure.
And then after that visit was over, I never heard from Ken again. You know, they were like, you know, who's this guy? He's a borderline recruit as it is, and he doesn't want to take an official visit. And then I ended up having to re-recruit myself back to Kent.
Okay.
Yes, as the end of my senior year started coming along, and thankfully they had a guy transfer, and I was the seventh freshman in a class of, you know, seven scholarship players, and it just happened to work out for me. But I think if I had been better educated or had somebody that had known the ropes, A, they would have told me, you take that official visit if you have a Division I school that's interested in you, if that's your goal. And then two, I think I would have had somebody probably mentoring me saying, hey, you should really look at some of these opportunities. And I did sort of look at them, but I had in my mind kind of like the players that, you know, we've been talking about tonight, that, you know, I was kind of a Division I or bust. So I can definitely relate to the mentality, but I think that what's missing is what you're providing, which is the education about what are some of these opportunities that could have been just as good for me, but were just at a different level than the one that I had stuck in my head where I wanted to be. And so thankfully for me, like I said, it worked out great because I ended up being in the right place, but it very easily, I could have ended up in the wrong place and I could have had a much different experience. And, you know, I think if I had known more about the options that were at other levels of college basketball, I would have widened my scope of what I would have looked at. So
he does have two records at Kent State still, though. So that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty good.
That is pretty good. I mean, I ended up having a pretty good career, but nonetheless, right. I mean, that's the point of the story is that, you know, I was kind of a Division I or bust person. And even at that point,
most people are. You know, I think a large percentage of players are even today. And that's unfortunate. I mean, you know, I think, and I spent a great deal of time with this. In fact, I've been blessed due to the sponsorship that I recently announced that for the next several months, this is all I'm going to be doing. I actually took a leave of absence from my job where I provide therapy. And this is all I'm going to be doing for maybe the next 3 to 4 months, just hitting the road, spreading the word, speaking engagements and things about the college basketball process in general. But people often ask me, if you had to pinpoint one thing that needs to change to try to shift this narrative, it's very difficult for me to pinpoint one thing. There's two things that I think would help dramatically. The primary is people changing the way they evaluate players. We have created this system across the board, and a lot of times it's simply because of people not knowing. But we've created this system across the board of providing an evaluation based on level. Well, I don't think there's any way you can evaluate that's more incorrect unless you're, say, a top 100 or 200 player in the country. Because if you know, I had an opportunity to meet you up at the Kenny Anderson Showcase, and there were a couple kids that walked through the door that turned some heads, and people were talking about, and they were asking about, hey, you know, I was blessed to meet a couple of coaches up in the area at Lakeland, and I was talking to Kenny and a couple of the other coaches, and I overheard some people in the crowd talking, oh, well, he's a D1. Well, what does that even mean? If I label you and evaluate you as a D1 player, and I don't want to call out any school, but I feel like I have a good enough relationship with some of the schools that I mentioned that they won't necessarily care. But does that, if I say you're a D1 kid, does that mean you're going to Duke? Does that mean you're going to Kentucky? Does that mean you're going to Ohio State? Or does that mean you're going to Alabama A&M? Because the reality is there's a stark difference in those. And that's no knock on Alabama A&M. It's a great university. I know the entire coaching staff there. But the reality is that that's a different player that's playing at the University of Kentucky than is playing at Alabama A&M. And so both great players, but there is a difference. And for me to call a kid a Division I player is so misleading because what does that mean? And I think as long as we provide a label through an evaluation of D1, D2, D3, NAIA, it's going to be very confusing and very misleading and only continue to add to the problem. Because I can give you an example. There was a kid several years back, and he's not a kid anymore. He's probably in his 30s now. But there was a guy that played at Wright State, started at Wright State as a freshman, started as a sophomore, was I think he was all freshman I think he was all conference freshman team, and he had some kind of award as a sophomore. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but then he transferred as a junior down to Georgetown College in Kentucky, and he didn't even start. And he struggled to even hit the floor, really. I think he averaged like 10 minutes a game. And we're talking about a guy that was all conference freshman and started for Wright State. And then he got to an NAIA and he literally didn't start. I can provide examples all across the country. Good friend of mine through coaching down at Florida College, they had an NAIA, a D1 transfer. They're an NAIA school. He didn't start for them. So I can provide multiple examples of players who were significant players in the system they were in. So was it fair to not evaluate those guys as D1 players? Well, obviously not, because they were good enough to play D1, but at the same time, they weren't good enough to start for the programs they transferred to. And so providing those levels are very, very misleading as an evaluation tool. And I continue to go back. I'm a big NAI advocate. People ask me all the time why I love that level so much. And to me, they're the wild card of college basketball. First of all, they have the oldest college basketball tournament in the country. It was started by Dr. Naismith himself, and it goes back years and years. I mean, it's the oldest one. But as I talk about Georgetown College a lot, and a couple years back, they were starting a University of Louisville transfer, a Texas Tech transfer. I mean, people just don't understand what's out there. And, you know, I have parents reach out and say, well, don't you think my kid could at least play for this school? And that tends to be what happens, because they've heard forever that they're D1 or this, that, and other. So then they think to themselves, well, can't they at least play for Georgetown College? And I'm like, well, if you can't play at the University of Louisville, you're probably not playing at Georgetown College, because that's who's starting at that position right now.
Right.
And so one of the things I tend to say is, if you're not D1 potential, you won't be an impact player anywhere. And I kind of stand by that. I mean, you may make a roster somewhere, but you're not going to be an impact player. And so that's the first part of it that I think is needs to change. And without that, I'm not sure that anything will ever truly make any significant difference. And lastly, something that's getting ready to happen that I'm very proud of with the NCAA that they're doing this year, that I think it should become a tradition. The D2 and D3 men's championships is actually going to be played the same weekend in the same venue as the D1 championship. And they've done this a couple times, but this is and the times that they've done, it's been in Atlanta, but that's happening again this year. So I think when Division I, especially considering that they're all the same organization, I think when they truly embrace D2 and D3 and make a tradition where you've got the masses coming and watching the Final Four game. So the way it's going to be laid out is you're going to have the Final Four game on Saturday. And then on Sunday is going to be the D2 and D3 national championship game. And on Monday will be the D1 national championship game. So I think when small changes like that are made on a consistent basis and they put it, you know, set it that way, I think there'll be a lot of people start to realize what's out there, televising those national championship games, not on a streaming service, but actually televising those games will bring a lot of awareness to it and open the eyes to many people that it's good basketball.
Yeah. And I think what I pull out of a lot of what you're saying there is, and it speaks to the Division I transfer, you know, the transfer numbers, and just you have to be in the right situation. And because people aren't educated about what opportunities are out there, about what certain schools are looking for, about what certain levels are all about, I think a lot of times people make decisions that if they were better educated, they would know going into that situation that it wasn't the best one for their kid, whether that's academically because they're just so focused on basketball and they're not worried at all about the school and its location and its academics and it just its environment and the kid doesn't fit, or it's from a basketball standpoint they've reached, or somebody, you know, they'd say, I'm going to walk on here, I'm going to try to get to this place or whatever, because they have this vision in their mind and they're not educated about what their opportunities are. And I think with what you're trying to do is to show people that, look, if you can play basketball beyond high school one, you've got to be a really, really good player to be able to pick up a basketball and play on a college team, no matter what level that is.
100%.
You have to be really good. And most parents of kids who are in grades 4 through 11, 4 through 12, wherever you want to make those cutoffs, have no idea how good a player has to be able to play college basketball. So that's number one. And then number two, people just don't have an understanding of what the various opportunities are and how you can get a great education. You can have a great experience. You can continue to play a game that, if your kid loves the game, they can continue to play for another 4 years, which a lot of people, that ball stops bouncing on the last game of their senior year in high school. And yep, for kids who have an opportunity to keep playing, I don't know why you would look down on that opportunity. That's what's frustrating.
It's interesting that you said that. I can recall my son's last high school game. They lost a heartbreaking game to go to the state tournament. And it just coincided with so the school that my son went to out of high school is a really high level NAIA school in Kentucky called Lindsey Wilson College. And I actually mentioned one of the coaches. His name was Paul Peck. And it coincided with them being in the area for a game that they were playing. And he was hoping to get finished with the game in time to come over and watch the end of my son's game, but it didn't happen. But he did get to talk to him on the phone, and it was a piece of advice that is very along the lines of what you're saying. My son was just torn apart. It was a gut-wrenching loss, and he ended up fouling the kid who went to the free throw line to essentially, he didn't win the game, but it put the team in position to win the game. And so he didn't forgive himself, you know, being a team leader and whatnot. And when Coach Peck called to ask him about the game, my son was tearful. And he said, you know, this is not the way I wanted to go out. This is my last high school game. And he was, you know, crying. It got pretty bad, actually. Couldn't really talk. The emotions were hitting him. And I'll never forget Coach Peck saying this. He said, you don't need to be crying for that. He said, because you're going to have a chance to go on and play. And you're so talented, you may even play professionally. He said, you need to turn around and cry for the 11 guys in the locker room with you who this was their last game.
That's so true.
And I'll never forget that. And it stuck with me. It was powerful, and it instantly hit my son as well, because he kind of perked up a little bit and really took in the moment and understood how blessed he was to be able to move on. And it's true, because so many kids would give up everything to play at a D3 school just to have that opportunity. And I hate pushing professional basketball, because what I do is not about professional basketball. It's about getting kids in college to use the game they love to change their life. But the reality is this: there's more professional basketball players overseas from non-D1 schools than there are D1 schools. That's a real statistic from usbasket.com. It's a reality. So giving up the D1 dream doesn't mean you have to give up the professional dream. And in many instances, it can even help you more. So we just need to do all we can to continue to spread awareness, education, understanding, and really spread the different levels. Because, I mean, there's great opportunities out there. There's a school in Virginia, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, called the Apprentice School.
I have not.
And the Apprentice School is amazing. It's basically a shipbuilding apprentice program. And they have a team. They play in the USCAA, and you have to have a really good math aptitude, but you can do various apprentice programs and make really good money while you're going to school. So there's seniors playing for that team that are making like 40 and 50 grand, and I'm not exaggerating. With families that are getting ready to start careers. And I'm not exaggerating at all. There's literally seniors on the team in their mid 20s that are making 40 grand a year playing basketball. because it is a apprentice program. But since they also offer degrees, they're allowed to field a team. And so there's just so many unique opportunities out there. Berea College in Kentucky is a work study program. Every kid accepted into the school goes for free. Now there's requirements obviously that you have to meet, but every single kid in the school attends school for free. With the work study aspect, there's things that you have to do in terms of holding down a position. Maybe you're a janitor, or you work tickets for games, or you work in the kitchen or something. But there's so many opportunities out there that people just do not know about that could realistically change your life using a game. That same game that I fell in love with a guy on a dirt court with a milk crate, you know, as a hoop. It can change your life.
No question. No doubt about that. All right. We're coming up on an hour and a half, William. So I want to wrap it up with one final question for you. And that is, you've talked a lot about kind of where you are with the college basketball process and how you're still kind of trying to figure out and morph and see what this thing is going to become. So as you look down the road, what are one or two things that you see that you definitely want to, that you definitely want to do, or that you definitely see coming, and ways that you can add value for people out there to help them make better decisions, make better choices, and ultimately get the experience out of the game and out of the school that they want? How are you going to do that?
Well, one thing is, I was kind of anti-website in the beginning, but we do have a website coming that is going to, I think, based on some information and feedback I've received, it's going to be an invaluable tool. I'm working on some content, anything that I ever put out in terms of tutorial videos or recruiting information or just anything that I put out is going to be readily available to the masses. You don't have to follow me on Twitter. You don't have to have a Twitter account. You're going to be able to log on and see all of these things. I'm going to have it's basically just going to be one big service of information for people to access. We're going to have links to eligibility websites, D1, D2, D3, NAIA requirements to be able to play, some stuff about transfers that are very important. A lot of people don't know some of the tricky things that come along with transfers. It almost sounds like a math problem, but there's a 2-4 transfer, a 4-2 transfer, a 4-2-4 transfer, and some of those things get kind of tricky. And so we're going to have information and links about all of that stuff. Just really, the website is going to be huge because it's going to be so accessible to so many people that don't necessarily do social media. So that's primarily going to be one thing we're going to do is make that available to the masses.
So when's the release date? When do you anticipate having that up and running?
If it is not up by the second week of July, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to maintain my sanity. So I'm shooting for the second week of July. The majority of the content is on the service, the server and the website. It's going to be the collegebasketballprocess.com. The name is in place. Everything's in place. But I think that's going to be really helpful. We're going to do some stuff with AAU programs, and I'm starting to work out some possibilities of speaking to large events, things like the Best of the South and things like that, these huge massive events where we have an opportunity to speak to the masses, kind of just explain some stuff with the process. I've been endorsed by so many people. I'm wildly blessed to say I've received endorsements from former NBA All-Stars down to JUCO coaches you've never heard of and everything in between. It's all about figuring out a way. You know, the wins and the losses, you know, that's part of basketball. The awards are great. Everything comes along with it. But the one person that means more to me in basketball now than anyone else is Coach Quanzo Martin in Missouri. I love his philosophy. I love everything about what he does. He has shared some just very uplifting words with me. And the game is just one small part of it. It's all about something bigger than basketball. And just figuring out a way to share this with people to change their lives. So the website's going to be one part of that. But the second part is going to be trying to develop these connections and networks with these promoters and these events to be able to get out and start spreading the word. And right now it's looking good. I've got a couple major events that are ready to sign on for 2020, major events. So I don't want to drop their names yet, but it is appearing that two of the largest summer tournaments in the country will have me on board next year as a speaker.
That's awesome.
And if that comes to fruition, I think that's a good start to spread the word. So those are the two things I really want to get in place in the next year.
All right. Before we get out of here, I want to give you a chance to share your Twitter handle and also all of your social media stuff so that people know where they can find you and get your information so they can reach out to you directly and get everything that we've been talking about tonight, get educated, learn more about the process. And then after you share all that out, we'll wrap up the episode and go from there.
Sounds good. Primarily we operate on Twitter. That's been the bread and butter so far. I'm on Twitter at Tweets by Coach P. The collegebasketballprocess.com is how you can get on the website. Like I said, that should be live the second week of July. You can email me, Coach P, at the College Basketball Process. That's already live. You can feel free to reach out in it for anything. It doesn't matter to me. If player evaluations, questions. I'm also on Instagram. That's one of the new forms that we're developing. That's Posts by Coach P on Instagram. Don't do Facebook. Flirting with the idea of creating a Facebook network for our members only. But if you have any questions about what we do, speaking engagements, any of that stuff, please reach out. We are a nonprofit, so we are definitely operating on a shoestring budget. So anything that we can work out, absolutely reach out, and we'll do anything we can to spread this word and help you out. Again, that's Tweets by Coach P on Twitter, and the website's going to be thecollegebasketballprocess.com.
William, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us. I think the information that you've given to people in our audience is invaluable, and I think anybody who's out there listening, if you're in the college basketball recruiting process as a parent, as a player, as a high school coach, you just want to become more educated about what that whole process is all about, you definitely want to make sure that you follow William on Twitter and his social media. And I think once the website, some of the things that he shared with me that he's going to have on there, that's going to be an invaluable tool as well. So I would highly recommend going out and following him in as many places as you possibly can. William, again, thank you so much for jumping on with us. We really appreciate it. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our Academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.